Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin, and we're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, February the 14th, 2018. We begin with the news section. Suffer the Children. North Carolina has one of the country's highest infant death rates. Expanding Medicaid could change that. The central premise is straightforward enough and commonsensical. Women who have better access to health care are less likely to have children who die soon after birth. So, since North Carolina's infant death rate is unnervingly high, 39th in the country, the state should expand access to health care for women of reproductive age. Essentially, our argument is that research has already shown that mothers who have access to prenatal care are less likely to experience infant mortality, says NC Child Research Director Whitney Tucker. If we're able to provide more health care, we're likely to see those infant and fetal mortality rates go down. Last week, the Child Advocacy Organization released its report, co-authored by Tucker, grimly titled, Giving Birth in North Carolina is Still a Risky Business. It lays out precisely that case too many North Carolina women lack access to health care, but the state can remedy that by expanding Medicaid. And it's not just infant mortality North Carolina carer's child is worried about. To Tucker, the report's most jarring finding is that while North Carolina infant death rate is still frustratingly high at 7.2 per 1,000 live births, nearly as many children experience fatal death as 1-8, meaning they perished after 20 weeks of gestation, which is commonly known as stillbirth, as infant death, 873 in 2016. The national infant death rate is 5.8 per 1,000 live births, which itself is higher than that of most developed countries. The number of fetal deaths, the report notes, has ranged from 753 to 895 per year over the last decade, and the fetal mortality rate fluctuated very little in the state between 2007 and 2013. The rate rose sharply between 2014 and 15, and fell in 2016, but has yet to decline past 2007 levels, despite increased statewide interest in investment in infant and maternal health. It's hard to get a sense of where North Carolina ranks in fetal death, as not all states maintain analogous records. But it's not hard to see the racial disparities at play. While the state's fetal death rate was 5.2 per 1,000 live births from 2012 to 2016, it is more than twice that, 12 per 1,000 for African Americans. For both fetal and infant deaths, the underlying problems are the same. Fetal and infant health is directly tied to maternal health status, preconception, and during the gestational period, the North Carolina Child Report says. Nearly half of the primary cases of infant mortality in North Carolina have been linked to maternal risk factors occurring prior to pregnancy. Similarly, while direct causes of fetal mortality are less understood in most cases, studies have also found maternal health conditions to be the leading health risk factors for fetal death. And underlying that is the fact that in North Carolina, one in five women of reproductive age does not have health insurance. According to the report, uninsured women are less likely than their insured peers to receive treatment or counseling for a variety of pregnancy risk factors, including mental health concerns and the physical health conditions referenced earlier in this report. Uninsured adults are twice as likely as their insured peers to forego seeing a doctor when they are sick, and are less likely to receive services to help them manage chronic disease or major health conditions. These are state resources. There are state resources available to lower-income pregnant women. The Medicaid for Pregnant Women program covers women who earn up to 196% of the federal poverty line, or about $48,000 for a family of four. In fact, Medicaid covers 54% of all births in North Carolina, according to North Carolina Child. While Medicaid for pregnant women is a critical program, the report says, it is insufficient in providing all of the preconception and early pregnancy coverage women need to promote healthy pregnancies. The answer, the report argues, is to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, which would give health care access to an estimated 500,000 North Carolinians. Currently, 43% of the state's non-elderly, uninsured adult women fall into what is known as the coverage gap, meaning they earn too much to qualify for Medicaid, but not enough to obtain insurance subsidies through the Affordable Care Act's marketplace. Indeed, a recent study in the American Journal of Public Health found that infant mortality climbed more in states that had expanded Medicaid than in those that did not, with greater declines among African-American infants, which, as North Carolina Child points out, is a particularly vulnerable population in North Carolina. But if the solution is obvious to North Carolina Child, it hasn't been to the General Assembly, which has steadfastly refused to expand Medicaid. In 2013, legislatures even passed a law explicitly forbidding it. Democrats have pointed out that the state is leaving billions of dollars on the table, since under the ACA, the federal government picks up about 90% of the expansion tab. From 2013 to 22, according to the 2014 report from the Urban Institute, the state would have had to cough up about $300 million a year in exchange for $3.9 billion a year in federal funding and another billion in hospital reimbursements. When Governor Cooper took office in the waning days of the Obama administration, he made noise about unilaterally expanding the program, which prompted a lawsuit by the House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate Leader Phil Berger. Cooper never followed through, however, so the lawsuit was dropped. But then last month, the Trump administration changed the equation. It began allowing states to impose work requirements on able-bodied Medicare recipients, something Republicans have long sought to do. Cooper sought a waiver to the work requirement provision in November, but the requirements would only apply if the state expanded Medicare, and then only to the people in the expanded Medicaid program. It was an olive branch. So far, legislative leaders haven't accepted it. There are good reasons to be skeptical of work requirements. As the North Carolina Child Report points out, health problems are often a reason people are unemployed. According to a recent study in Michigan, 75% of out-of-work Medicaid recipients had a chronic health condition, which would seem to indicate that work requirements are a solution to a problem that doesn't really exist. But even so, advocates say, expansion is worth it. A bill filed last year in the legislature, House Bill 662, would expand Medicaid while imposing work requirements on a premium of 2% of household income. But what separates it from previous failed attempts to expand Medicaid is that its four primary sponsors are Republicans. I do think having four Republicans as primary sponsors on this helps, says Wake County Democratic State Representative Dwayne Hall, a co-sponsor. He's supported Medicaid expansion since he joined the State House and has co-sponsored straight Medicaid expansion bills that went nowhere. He adds, "Our failure to expand Medicaid is the biggest disappointment I've had since I've been in the legislature." Whether that means House Bill 662 will see movement once the short session convenes in May is anyone's guess. After all, Hall told the Indy Thursday, the day the Republicans unveiled a class-size mandate reprieve that would also take control of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline Mitigation Fund and reestablish a bipartisan state board of education that has twice been rejected by state courts, you're asking a Democrat who didn't know what was on the floor before is on the floor. Our next news article, Trust issues. Durham wants to establish a new housing trust fund that relies on private donations. What will it look like? And will it even work? Last Monday, Durham Mayor Steve Shule delivered his first State of the City address. The hour-long speech was wide-ranging. Shule called on Durham residents to plant trees and help correct decades-old disparities in the city's tree canopy. He sang the words inscribed on the Statue of Liberty and welcomed, in Spanish, the families of two men taking sanctuary from deportation in Durham. He announced some important quiet work being done to address the city's critical lack of affordable housing. Under the leadership of Fail Wynn, Vice President for Durham and Regional Affairs at Duke University, the city is working to set up an affordable housing trust fund. Trust funds aren't uncommon, but it appears Durham's will be unique and that it will rely on private contributions rather primarily on government resources. In an interview, Shule stresses that plans for the fund are in the very early stages. As the Durham Housing Authority begins a massive redevelopment effort and the city gears up to deliver on its commitment to locating affordable housing around light rail stations, Durham will need more resources to throw at the problem of affordability. According to the Housing Trust Fund Project, initiative of the Center for Community Change, there are 98 city housing trust funds across the country, including two in North Carolina, in Asheville, and in Charlotte. In addition, hundreds of jurisdictions in New Jersey and Massachusetts participate in broader funds in those states. There are also state housing trust funds, including one operated by the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency. All told, these funds dedicate more than $1.2 billion annually to housing efforts. Shule says a trust fund would provide a more flexible addition to the city's existing dedicated housing fund, a repository for the proceeds of portion of the property tax earmarked for housing and doled out through the annual budget. He envisions a $15 million fund, with about 10% of that coming from the city and the rest from private sources, such as Duke University or financial institutions. The money would be loaned mostly to nonprofit developers. Wynn is meeting with financial institutions, nonprofit housing developers, and city staff to bring the idea to fruition. The key thing would be, of course, the willingness of private funders to contribute. The commitment of Duke will be very, very important, Shule says. I think if the fund is going to work, the city is going to have to put it in the top loss, that initial risk capital. The other part of the picture is the potential for a housing bond. Shule says he anticipates a bond issue will be needed sooner than later, given the DHA's redevelopment plans. The dedicated housing fund would maintain the city's regular commitments to affordable housing and the nonprofits that work to provide it, while the trust fund could be used for larger or off-the-budget cycle expenditures. You can be more nimble and have more money at your fingertips, Shule says. A trust fund could have come in handy last year when the DHA had the opportunity to buy back 20 acres of land south of NC 147 and sought $4 million from the city to make that happen before the deadline to purchase the property known as Fayetteville Place expired. Shule says he could also envision the trust fund being used to renovate units that are existing affordable housing agreements as leverage to negotiate new affordability requirements. Michael Anderson, director of the Housing Trust Fund Project, says that what Durham is proposing to do, based on the few details available, doesn't fit the traditional definition of a housing trust fund. Almost every trust fund for private contributions, but having private contributions as a core part of your business model, is entirely different, he said. Generally, city trust funds are primarily backed by tax revenue, developer fees, and bonds. Three jurisdictions in Iowa report using private dollars as a funding source. Those are mostly backed by money from a state housing trust fund, but they also receive private contributions. Anderson also notes a collaboration in Ithaca, New York, where Cornell University matches what the local government contributes to a housing trust fund. Addressing housing needs is often just too big a task for private funds alone, Anderson says. Housing trust funds that are reliant on private dollars often never get a critical mass of funding beyond initial contributions made to jumpstart them. There's just not examples of philanthropy stepping up to an ongoing way for a problem that for the last four decades, in our country, has been really consistent, he said. That said, there's nothing wrong with utilizing private dollars, Anderson said. We always say, leave that door open. There's great examples of private money helping, but not taking the lead over public money. Shule hopes to have the fund in place by the end of this year. And now this week's feature article, 28 Reasons We Love the Triangle, a Valentine's Day love letter to the place we call home. Maybe it's the beer. Maybe it's the food. Maybe it's our particular brand of progressive activism. Maybe it's the fact that we have the greatest sports rivalry known to humankind. Maybe it's our stages or the artists who perform on them. Maybe it's the serenity of nature which we have in abundance. Or maybe it's all of these things and more. At the Indy, we're often called to be the bearer of bad tidings. That there are lots of reasons to love the Triangle, which is why we hold the place to such high standards. Every year, okay, at least since last year, on the week of Valentine's Day, we like to celebrate the things that keep us here in fighting, that make Raleigh and Durham and Chapel Hill and Carrboro and Cary such vibrant, dynamic places to live. But this love letter to the weird, wonderful region we call home is also meant to whet your appetite. Later this month, we'll launch voting for this year's Best of the Triangle nominations and give you the chance to support your favorite stores and restaurants, hair salons, and dentists. It's almost your turn to tell us what you love about the Triangle. Keep an eye on our social media. Details are coming soon. Here come the reasons. Because we have the best college sports rivalry on earth. You've never experienced a hate like this. Whether you were born to a family indeed prejudiced for NC State, UNC, or Duke, or have chosen your allegiance through careful contemplation, there's no denying your flaming hatred for the other two. This hate, present all year round but especially prevalent during basketball season, manifests in epic ways. Get caught in the stampede of UNC students rushing Franklin Street after beating Duke. Duke students camping in Crazetville for weeks before a big game. Or state fans lighting up the bell tower red. Oh, and don't forget the bragging rights you earn when your team wins, otherwise known as a license to annoy the hell out of all of your friends who rooted for the other team. Number two. Because our beer scene is crazy good. The other day I was in line at Total Wine buying a six-pack. The couple in front of me told the cashier they were visiting from Maryland. It's weird how you all have separate stores for beer and liquor, one said. But it's cool how there's beer everywhere. Thank you, Maryland man, for putting succinctly what we all feel. Not only are we blessed with award-winning breweries like Linwood Brewing Concern, Bond Brothers, Crank Arm, Full Steam, and Mystery Brewing, but there are hundreds of places to enjoy a pint, local or otherwise. Beer is so common that a whole economy of beer-based events has been born. We're not just talking trivia night and Girl Scout cookie pairings, though we have those to spare. explore the North Carolina Museum of Natural Science with a cold one in hand on adult nights, John Fulstein, to plant trees in Durham, or learn about astronomy. Or just grab a stool at your neighborhood bar, raise a glass, and toast the triangle. Number three, because Amazon likes us better than Charlotte. It's okay to have mixed feeling about Raleigh's bid for Amazon's HQ2. Sure, you might be excited about those 50,000 good-paying jobs, but also a little trepidatious about the masses of traffic and gentrification that's sure to accompany it, should the triangle win. And that's not even getting into the wisdom of throwing the richest man in the world a few billion dollars in incentives. We'll see how that all shakes out in the next couple of months. The important thing for our purposes is that there are four North Carolina regions that submitted bids to Amazon: the Triangle, the Triad, Charlotte, and Hickory. And the only one that made the list of the finalists was the Triangle, much to Charlotte's consternation. So, say you want about Amazon, but at least they recognize our region's dominance. Next, because our comedy scene isn't putting up with any of that toxic masculinity crap. Given the misogynistic tinge of so much stand-up, it's not surprising that the hashtag MeToo movement has flourished in the comedy world. And maybe it's also not surprising that the women of the Triangle, an area with a rich history of progressive resistance, have so strongly pushed back. First, last year came the downfall of Zach Ward of DSI Comedy Theater, following an outbreak of accusations on Facebook of toxic masculinity and the swift closure of Chapel Hill's longtime improv magnet. Then came the premonitory outcry against its replacement, the People's Improv Theater, which seems to have similar issues with lax sexual harassment policies. But there's not just resistance, there's also forward momentum. Aaron Terry's steadfast Eyes Up Here comedy showcase, which features all women comedians, and newer troupes such as Meddlesome, are all doing comedy for a world after the fall of Louis C.K. Number five. Because our chefs win James Beard Awards and our restaurants make the hot stuff national lists. Every time someone from out of town asks me about our famed local food scene, I say, hot stuff, in my head, like I'm Nelly about to launch into a lecture on country grammar. Except it's more like country cooking and dispelling myths about southern food being ordinary. There's a reckoning happening in our food scene, and our chefs are owning it, while racking up national accolades every year. For me, the most notable recent praise is Garland owner Chidi Kumar's James Beard nod for Best Chef Southeast. Semifinalist will be announced February the 15th. A musician and chef, Kumar performs rituals in the kitchen that fuse a mastery of Indian spices with local ingredients that dance on our palates. She just cooked up a late-night feast for Robert Plant. And Brewery Bahama was ranked among Bon Appetit's top 10 best new restaurants in the country, for good reason. It's one of our most beautiful restaurants, for one, and blends southern and immigrant hospitality effortlessly in its unique combinations of Laotian entrees and Shanghai-style dim sum. A stellar 40-tap brewery, immaculate flower shop arrangements, and a woke AF bookstore. Next, because our bars take their booze seriously. You hit up any dive bar to get your boozy fix, and there's also a sophistication to getting sloshed around there. Our bars elevate cocktail menus and wine lists to the level of our food scene, making it a great place to try new things. But Bar Brunello in Durham has an unparalleled selection of orange wines, celebrating the young Italian winemaking big waves around the world. Raleigh's Bittersweet boasts the largest selection of gin in the state. There's bourbon aplenty at Blind Barber, classic and innovative cocktails at joints like Foundation and Fox Liquor Bar, and plenty of brown liquor at the appropriately named Whiskey Kitchen. And we can finally get decent mezcal without booking flights to Oaxaca at Gallo Pelon. Number 7. Because we tore down the Confederate Monument. North Carolina state law prohibits the removal of objects of remembrance like Confederate monuments, but last summer a group of protesters in Durham found a way around the law by ignoring it, basically. Looping a tow strap around a Confederate monument on Main Street and bringing it crumbling to the ground. Video was seen around the country and even brought a Dutch film crew to the Bull City. It was enough to frighten Baltimore officials into removing that city's Confederate monuments under the cover of night. The action touched off a week of demonstrations in Durham, and months later, a conversation continues as to what people, places, and events should be memorialized. With Chapel Hill and Raleigh still stuck staring at their own Confederate monuments, it's clear no other city can quite do it like Durham. Number 8. Because radicals dominate Durham City Council. For decades, at least until revanchist Republicans retook control of the General Assembly in 2010, North Carolina considers itself something of a modernist, if not always progressive, lighthouse in the Deep South. Today, it's the state's urban areas leading the way, often in conflict with the legislature, on issues of civil rights and social justice. And nowhere in North Carolina is that dynamic as apparent as in Durham, where following last year's election and an appointment in last month, all 7 members, from Major Steve Shule on down, could fairly be described as avowed and unwavering progressive, maybe even radicals. Theirs will be an activist council board and determined to claim the mantle of most progressive city in the South. And if nothing else, it'll be fun to watch. Number 9. Because we have a bunch of local politicians destined for higher office. Durham has the radicals, and among them some Poles we'd love to see take their game to another level, like Jillian Johnson. But the bench is no less deep on the other side of the triangle. On the Wake County Board of Commissioners, for instance, there's John Burns, Matt Calabria, and Jessica Holmes, all smart, engaging potential stars in North Carolina Democratic politics. Calabria is planning to run for the State House this year. On the Raleigh City Council, expect similarly good things from newcomer Nicole Stewart. Dig a little deeper and you'll find Jenna Wadsworth, the youngest woman ever elected to office in North Carolina, the Wake County Soil and Water Conservation Board, at age 21 back in 2010. There are others, of course, both in local bodies and the state legislature, and some that aren't even on the radar right now. But the point is, the triangle is awash in progressive political talent right now, and that's pretty cool. Next, because we run, and then we drink. It's easy to hop on the fitness trend in a place with so many great options for breaking a sweat. The triangle is littered with studios and gyms that are the fruition of the dreams of some very inspirational and motivated locals. Not into traditional classes? We've got organizations like Raleigh Group Fitness, which switches up small group workouts around the triangle to keep you on your toes. Maybe running is your jam, in which case, hit up one of the many run clubs around the triangle. With different pace and mile options for people of all levels, run clubs are a great way to break into the fitness community. Best of all, many run clubs are also associated with some of our best local breweries. Big Boss Run Club, Full Steam Run Club, Bond Brothers Run Club, and Nog Run Club out of the Raleigh Beer Gardens. Talk about work hard, play hard. Next, because we brunch like champs. Say what you want about the popularity of brunch. There's no denying we serve it up right. Sure, we've got avocado toast, biscuits and gravy, and all the other standard fare you could hunt down somewhere else. But our brunch spots have a lot more to offer than vegan tofu breakfast burritos, as irregardless to the namesake chicken and waffles at Dame's. From giant slices of quiche Lorraine at Coquette to churros at Beasley's. Extra points for the Triangle getting on board with the state's brunch bill last summer. And on Sunday morning, nothing beats a bottomless mimosa from Mia Francesca or a Bloody Mary at Flying Biscuit. Number 12. Because there are 15 parks within 15 minutes of my house. Within a 15-minute drive from my apartment, there are 7 nature preserves and 8 parks, not to mention access to the Eno River, Duke Forest, and Serapis Duke Gardens. It's rare enough to have so much nature just outside your door, but in the Triangle, we have it alongside all the amenities of a mid-sized city. I'm partial to the Johnston Mills' 297 acres and 5 trails, which wind past 100-year-old trees and historic mill. Hollow Rock is a hidden gem near New Hope Commons. It's great for a quick hike, especially if you take the trail backward and end at the dramatic Hanging Rock for a George of the Jungle-style chest pound. You can enjoy a picnic on the banks of the Eno, or take in massive sculptures at the North Carolina Museum of Arts Park. From Carolina North Forest to Umstead Park, there are thousands of acres to explore. Next, because you can hike along the Eno River until you collapse. There are dozens of quality hiking trails throughout the Triangle. Umstead State Park in Raleigh, Okanoche Mountain State Park in Hillsboro, and so on. But my favorite is a long hike along the Eno River itself. There's a good entry point off of Guess Road in Durham, just north of Rose of Sharon Road. From there, trek west, first the 2.5 miles to Pump Station, then take the Pump Station Trail for a little less than a mile until you can find the Laurel Bluffs Trail again. Continue west past Coal Mill Road all the way to Pleasant Green Road. Double back, and you're looking at about 12 miles. And if that's not good enough for you, you've had a short drive away from the sundry winding paths of the Eno River State Park, particularly the excellent and gorgeous Cox Mountain Trail. Next, because our locally made products rule. The Triangle is home to some seriously amazing entrepreneurs who have infused our economy with original products that can't be found elsewhere. Products like Chapel Hill Toffee, Bone Suckin' Sauce, and Kakalaki Spice Sauce draw inspiration from our classic southern roots. We have unique textiles in Raleigh denim and stitch. We have craft brewers to the best of the band from brewers like Gizmo Brew Works, Bond Brothers Beer Company, and Aviator Brewing Company, to name a few. And we have energy drinks to help with that hangover, courtesy of Maddie. Next, because our coffee scene is booming. It used to be that really good coffee came from niche producers in the Pacific Northwest or other large metropolitan markets. But in recent years, the Triangle has had its fair share of excellent coffee purveyors and roasters enter the game. In addition to established brands like Counterculture, Joe Van Gogh, Slingshot Coffee, and Carborough Coffee Company continuing to grow, new ones have popped up all over the area. In Durham, Coca Cinnamon launched Fourth Dimension Coffee with the opening of the shop's newest location in Lakewood. Two former Counterculture figures and national award-winning baristas founded Black and White Roasters in Wake Forest, inspired by her grandfather's roasting business. Gabriella Cabanaugh founded Cabello Roja in Durham. We're all a jitter waiting to see what new caffeinated concoction they can make for us. Next, because no matter where you live, there's a farmer's market nearby. Even with semi-erratic weather patterns, the Triangle can count itself truly blessed by a bounty of local produce all year round. With dozens of local farmer markets spread throughout the region and nearly every day of the week, the ingenuity of our farmers is on full display. Our organic farmers have been tolling longer than any hobby urban farmer in New York City, and even tobacco farmers have converted fields into environmentally conscious plots of sweet potatoes and collards. You can rest assured that you're buying direct from the farmer, too, as most local markets require that they're present at their stands. From Holly Springs and Fuquay Varino over to Hillsboro and Saxapaw, markets abound. In the more central areas, Carver offers ECO Farm Mushrooms, they're experts at growing shiitakes, and Trossa's Burmese crops, including a diversity of chilies and gourds, as well as fresh lemongrass from Transplanting Traditions Community Farm. Durham gives you a full street festival every Saturday morning. Pack a cooler for boxcar homemade cheese and Sunset Ridge bison sausage, and pick up Little Farms ginger syrup. Raleigh offers everything from a downtown weekly market to the enormous state-run market. Try Fertile Ground Cooperative's offering on the southwest side of town, too, and give back to social justice projects with your purchase. Next, we care about local landmarks. Not the ones we pull down, but the beacons that preserve our regional culture against a flood of outside development. We've sustained heavy losses in recent years, to be sure, with two nice prices down and Manbijbog Theater to follow this year. But look at what we're saving. Local readers have raised more than $50,000 and counting so that the Regulator Bookshop, a venerable Durham base of touring readings and local letters, could carry on after the retirement of its founders. A similar community drive is underway to save the Chelsea Theater in Chapel Hill, with film lovers banding together to try and turn it into a nonprofit, defending a precious sliver of old Chapel Hill. Should we go ahead and start GoFundMe pages for Sutton's and the Shrunken Head now? Next, because we've got a virtual reality arcade in Durham. Because we do, right? Here in the Silicon Piedmont, Augmentality Labs quietly opened on North Church Street last summer. It's co-owned by Alicia Hendrick, who also runs the NC Escape game on nearby Orange Street, and who seems intent on creating downtown respites from reality from Durhamites. A variety of single or multiplayer virtual reality games are on an offer, from shooters and fighters to simulators for $20 per half hour. That's pretty steep, but where else are you going to get your head in a $600 VIV display? Lovers, take note and act fast. There's a Valentine's Day package at 30% off because nothing says, "We're in this for the long haul," quite like spending Valentine's Day flailing around a mostly empty brick room with a funny visor. Next, because our folks are generous and philanthropic. Southern hospitality applies to all walks of life in the Triangle, as evidenced by the many locally based nonprofits and philanthropies that call RDU home. The Center for Child and Family Health in Durham works to prevent and treat childhood neglect, abuse, and trauma. Step Up Ministries in Raleigh aids adults in finding employment and giving them life training skills. IntraHealth International, Incorporated of Chapel Hill, seeks to improve the quality and accessibility of health services for people. These are just three of the dozens of organizations and programs cultivated by our generous and motivated locals. Next, because our local culture goes all over the world. It's always nice to be able to celebrate a locally made product, but the Triangle's movers and shakers don't just stay in their own backyards. Sure, we've got current bands like American Aquarium, His Golden Messenger, and Sylvan Esso that tour the globe. Other musicians like Superchunk, Algia Mae Hinton, Libya Cotton, and Ninth Wonder have permanently shaped indie rock, the blues, folk music, and hip-hop. Durham's Duffer Brothers are responsible for the smash hit TV show Stranger Things, and Raleigh Denham's carefully crafted wares are celebrated in high and in department stores. Even the podcast Criminal, which is made in Durham, has fans around the globe. Next, because local African-American artists are chipping away at white supremacy. The local art scene touts its inclusivity, but the structural reality is that it's dominated by white institutions that shape white spaces for white audiences. Often African-American artists who are invited to the party still find their work distorted through a white lens. This will take generations to fully change, but it is changing in both academic and independent contexts. Last November, Carolina Performing Arts presented Toshi and Bernice Johnson Regan's stunning musical adaptation of Octavia E. Butler's Parable of the Sower, which demonstrated that if the Academy cedes its cultural perspectives to African-American artists, then a robust African-American audience will come to the usually snowy Memorial Hall. Earlier this month, Monet Noel Marcel's independent immersive theater piece, Buy My Soul and Call It Art, viscerally confronted black and white artists and audience with the stark differences between their privileges and experiences. And Black Ops Theater Company's newest Bull City Black Theater Festival is coming to Man Bites Dog in March. Inclusive isn't enough, and we love the Triangle because local artists are trying to change the shape of the container. Next, because there's data for everything. The Triangle is frequently recognized as a top tech hub. The explosion of this industry, along with the wealth of experts at local universities, means there is data for everything, even the percentage of North Carolinians who have, in the spirit of Petey Pablo, taken their shirt off and twisted it around their heads just like a helicopter. 15% for Raleigh-based public policy polling. True, the growth of tech has driven up real estate prices, but sometimes our techie side collides with our social justice side and does some good. Analysis of traffic stop data led to reforms at the Durham Police Department. DataWorks NC is studying Durham's high eviction rate, and the Center for Responsible Lending is tackling pretrial detention. The North Carolina Justice System and UNC's Poverty Research Fund are exposing issues of inequality statewide. If the first step is tackling any problem is understanding it, the Triangle is on good footing. Next, because NC State is upping its arts and culture game. Traditionally, you look to UNC and Duke for arts, NC State for tech. But in recent years, the engineering school has been catching up. In 2015, it completed a major renovation of Tally Street Union and making the campus main auditorium, Stewart Theater, much more inviting. Last year, the university moved its previously obscure Gregg Museum of Art and Design into a prominent, gracious Phil Freelon design building, giving State something like a Nasher of its own. The state-of-the-art James B. Hunt Jr. Library has become a reliable venue for all matter of cultural events, including off-site presentations of big authors by Quail Ridge Books, and NC State Live, University's Perf Arps presenter, whose most prominent shows used to tend toward fun for the whole family fair, is taking bigger artistic swings with strong bookings this season, such as legendary hip-hop choreographer Rennie Harris and the almost literal social justice warriors of urban bush women. Number 24, because we're finally getting Hamilton. We're not throwing away our shot. We're not throwing away our shot. Hey, yo, just like our country, we like munitions a bunch, see? And we're not throwing away our shot. Fans get a comp ticket to Hamilton. I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, that's the business I'm in. The problem is, we don't know exactly when it's coming. But a D-pack this year for sure. Lin-Manuel is stunning. Okay, fine, not him. I'll be a touring cast, and it might be next year before we see this at last. It's only like 3, but it feels like older. Do these Durham streets get mold, or we shudder? Every burden of being a smaller city market, up and coming, waiting our turn to really spark it. A diamond in the rough, a shiny piece of coal. Trying to reach our goal, blockbuster shows before they're cold. But we've learned to manage. There's always the sound of money, music. We're hyped for Hamilton, and we don't mean to abuse it. We get that New York is still the top of the game, but darn it, why can't we see some stuff at the height of its fame? Number 25, because our arts institutions are evolving to meet the needs of artists. The longer an institution exists, the harder it can be for it to change. So it says a lot about the strength of local dance that last year, October, the NC Dance Festival made a big change to meet our independent artists on their terms. After more than 25 years of presenting at Meredith College, the NCDP moved to the Rick House, a stages venue in downtown Durham, acknowledging that many dance artists now make work for intimate social spaces rather than large formal ones, and that you can't just plunk all the former down on the ladder. This month, UNC and Duke both cut ribbons on small, open, flexible theaters. Current Art Space and Studio and Von de Hayden Studio Theater, respectively, that will let audiences closely mingle with unconventional work as our academic presenters follow the lead of artists beyond the proscenium arch. Next, because we have the Duke Lemur Center. Have you ever looked at an eye in the eye or said hello to a Sifaka? In Durham you can. One of the city's best sort of secrets is the Durick Lemur Center, a research lab focusing on prosimian primates, our earliest evolutionary cousins. Research on lemurs, as it turns out, can tell us a whole lot about our human selves. Outside of the strictly science stuff, the Lemur Center has produced celebrities like Jovian, who was better known on TV as the titular creator of the PBS show Zumafu. To help with fundraising efforts, the center offers inexpensive tours that are as delightful as they are educational. You can't take a lemur home with you, but you can take home a little souvenir figure painted by a lemur. They have fun, too. Next, because Raleigh drops a giant nut on New Year's Eve. Anyone can drop a giant ball to commemorate the New Year. Boring. It takes a special group of people to suspend a 1,250-pound copper acorn in the middle of downtown to descend in time with the last seconds of the year. We are those people. Tacky? Yes. Weird? Yes. And we wouldn't have it any other way. Speaking of tacky, weird traditions, also see Raleigh's personal groundhog, Sir Walter Wally. Finally, number 28, because there's still an alt-weekly here. Look, we'll be straight with you here. The business of being a free weekly newspaper isn't easy. Alt-weeklies like the Indy have historically been essential pillars of journalism for their respective communities. We're not bound to formalism or deadliness of dailies. This allows us to dig deep and tell different kinds of important stories, like investigating hog farm corruption in the eastern part of the state. But all weeklies have been closing and contracting all over the country at an alarming rate. Even the LA Weekly, which was once of the Los Angeles biggest papers, is now a shell of its former self. Same goes for the Houston Press, which ended its print run in the wake of Hurricane Harvey. The Pitch in Kansas City, and Atlanta's Creative Loafing, which became monthlies. Even the freaking Village Voice, the granddaddy of them all, abandoned print last year. Fortunately, we at the Indy are lucky enough still to be here. We're happy and grateful to have been part of such a strong local community that we've served for 35 years. Here's to 35 more. We look forward to telling even more tough and vivid stories that you couldn't get anywhere else. Turning now to the food section, Emeralds of the Sea. North Carolina's green gilled oyster is as delicious as it is Instagrammable. On a Sunday afternoon in the middle of January, the Durham Hotel posted on Instagram that the rooftop bar would be featuring green gilled Core Sound oysters for $1 each until 7 p.m. or until they run out. By the time I arrived at 4, the bar had sold out. When I asked the server what the deal was, she simply shrugged. In the last few years, the North Carolina coast has become known for producing some of the best wild and cultivated oysters in the United States. National media often throw around the phrase, Napa Valley of the Oysters, when talking about our region. The Triangle's appetite for seafood has certainly expanded to accommodate the growth of oyster bars and seafood-centric spots. St. James Seafood in Durham, the Cortez in Raleigh, the rooftop of the Durham Hotel, and the second outpost of Saltbox Seafood, to name a few, consistently serve North Carolina oysters. More interest in oyster varieties from chefs and consumers means that the fishers on the coast have an audience eager to learn more about local seafood and to buy it. David Clammerhead Cessna, a nickname from his clam farming days, is the first North Carolina oysterman to specifically market green gills. His company, Sandbar Oyster Company, has trademarked them under name Atlantic Emeralds, which Cessna cultivates in the winter near Beaufort, North Carolina. The green gill is caused by a natural algae that grows on the bottom of the ocean in the winter when the water is clear enough to let the sunlight through. To determine where they cultivate oysters, farmers and fishers lease square miles of shallow water from the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries. We have a lease where the algae grows strong during the winter, so we're able to cultivate them consistently, Cessna says. He farms east of Beaufort on the North River. The oysters eat the blue algae and are stained an olive shade of green. When Cessna first began selling the green oysters, nobody wanted them. Raw green meat isn't very appetizing. But as consumers learn more about the intricacies and history of the oyster business, green gill's popularity grows. In the famous French oyster region of the Mamers-Oloron, for example, green gills are among the most prized cultivated oysters, which gives them their American counterpart a boost of good French appreciation. It has been a lot of education, Cessna says. They are different from what people are used to, but I think when you know that oysters are safe, people are excited to try something that seems new and different. But do they taste new and different? People never believe me when I say this, but they taste fluffy, he said. It's just something about the texture and the aftertaste. They're fluffy. People laugh, but then when they taste them, they say, huh, see what you mean. Matt Kelly, owner of St. James Seafood, describes green gills as product within a product. We get coarse sounders, for example, all the time, he says, but sometimes in winter they come in and they're all green-filled, and that's cool. People like them. I'm more interested in salinity levels. I like super salty oysters, but you do get a bit of that vegetal flavor, which is different. When I finally got to taste them, I found Atlantic emeralds pretty salty, but with a smoother finish than most. They're meatier than many North Carolina oysters, but less dense, which might be what Cessna means by fluffy. According to Local Seafood, a Raleigh-based seafood distributor that works directly with oyster farmers on North Carolina coast, Atlantic emeralds are currently available at Shucking Shack Durham, the Durham Hotel, and Coastal Provisions. Core Sound Green Gills are available at the Cortez at 40th Street Second Oyster Bar, Coastal Provisions, the Durham, St. James, Lantern, and 18th Seaboard. Cessna recommends that you get to these oysters as soon as possible. A fresh oyster is like a kiss, but a green gill oyster is like a kiss when you're in love, he explains, and they can be gone just as fast. And now some item from the back talk. We got quite the smorgasbord of commentary last week. Let's begin with Eric Kengard, who writes in response to a story on the 700,000 North Carolinians who live in deep poverty. He said, according to JLBJ, there should be no longer people in poverty, nor anyone dependent on means-tested welfare. The days of the dole in our country are numbered. Our American answer to poverty is not to make the poor more secure in their poverty, but to reach down and help lift themselves out of the ruts of poverty and move with the large majority along the high road of hope and prosperity. What happened? That's a good question. On a report about the state billing Willie to throw more than $1 billion at Toyota to locate a manufacturing plant here, which quoted from the News and Observer story, Alan Ferguson writes in a correction. Actually, the significant error in the NNO story, which has been corrected, is that it should be reading $100 million. Well, that's about it for this week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder that this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.